my name is Maria Schur, and this is how I spent my summer vacation.
Welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Aaron Flores, and I am figuring out how to produce the Sprocket, like actually getting it down this time. I can edit, so take that, Other Kelly, Coffee Kelly. I just called you Other Kelly. I'm sorry. You're not listening anyways. Or maybe you are. Anyways, where was I? Yes, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia. We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies, bleep, 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 bloop, of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way, covering bicycling, trains in transit, and simpler living. And today, we have a special treat. I recorded a interview with Maria Schur in her very own kitchen, way out in the southern parts of Cascadia, or of Portland, I should say. This is out in Lentz, what many people used to call Felony Flats. I used to live out there. I think the name might be slightly undeserved, but that's sort of the pejorative that it got. Adele one time pulled me aside and said, I've got a new name for Lentz. Instead of Felony Flats, I think we should call it Family Flats. Because the sort of felony element, not to say that there is no crime there, I think there is still a lot of need and a lot of desperation and a lot of poverty, which are good factors for promoting crime. But it's certainly calmed down a lot, and a lot of families are moving and are appearing there. That's Lentz. Maria Schur, on the other hand, has a house there. Or on the same hand, whatever. Has a house there. I went there. She gave me coffee. It was surprising. Surprising coffee. Maria puts cayenne pepper in her coffee. She drinks it sweet with cream, and so it adds a little bit of spice to that. She also mentioned she adds cayenne in her morning coffee for health reasons. For me, for the taste, it was kind of, in a way, like just an extra wake up. I don't know if I would do that normally. If I drank cream and sugar in my coffee, I could see where I could really grow accustomed to that little spice that she adds to it. But as it stands, I drink my coffee black, and it wasn't bad. I really liked the novelty of it. I liked the newness of it. But certainly, under my own normal, whatever. Yeah, my own choices. Wouldn't necessarily choose that. Anyways. So we got Maria Schur coming up. Also wanted to let you all know, a lot of people have been asking about Brock and where he's at. You know, where's his progress on his big trip? How is him and his wife Adele doing? So I will give you week one. They've been sending some dispatches, little mini recordings over to me. And I've kind of been neglectful. My apologies of putting those up on the site. Anyways, so I will put week one up right before the interview, and come back and we'll do week two and we'll end the show. No mail, no news, nothing like that. All you who've been writing in, thank you very much. I will get to you next week. In the meantime, this is an Aaron Light episode. Yeah, I'll see you on the other side.
We can't handle crowds.
We can't handle the crowds. Hi, it's Brock. This is Adele.
Hey there.
And we are in John Day, Oregon. It's June 21st. Yes, longest day of the year. We've been on the road since Monday. To quickly recap, I guess we were in Portland. We stayed on Mount Hood on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Went through Antelope. Stayed in, what was after that?
Oh my God. Where did we go after Antelope? I'm totally blanking out.
We went through the desert. And we ended up somewhere else. I think we ended up in Mitchell.
Oh, yeah, Mitchell. Yeah, on 26.
Yeah. Through the towns of Spray, back into Dayville last night, and here we are in John Day.
Here we are.
The biggest city we've seen since we left.
Yeah, we were just in the town park eating lunch, and there's a family fun day going on, and there's got to be hundreds of people there, which was a little overwhelming to us after being out for so long. I don't think we handle crowds very well anymore.
Right. It's kind of a culture shock to jump into a crowd of people. It was good to see it, though. Yeah, it seemed like everybody was having fun. We came to John Day on the day when everyone is coming out and having fun.
Yeah, there's the farmer's market started today. There was a big rummage sale in front of a church. Brock picked up a couple books for
20
trip
cents.
Literature for 20 cents. Got Steinbeck and
1984 by Orwell. Yes, both of which
haven't
I need to read.
Haven't read either. Yeah, those will be good.
We were in the Dayville Presbyterian Church last night, which offers a fantastic hospitality service to touring bicyclists. They're right on the Trans Am route, and they are very nice. They offer showers and laundry, as well as the use of their facilities while you're there. We got there at like 3 o'clock and didn't leave until 8. So we spent a lot of time there.
Good part of a day.
Yeah.
And the caretaker, Rose, is really sweet. She, Brock left a message on her phone that we were there. She didn't get the message before her neighbor told us that some bicyclists had arrived. So she hurried over and gave us the tour, which included showers and laundry facilities. You could sleep in the sanctuary of the church. You could sleep in the kitchen. You could sleep in their sort of cafeteria room. So we just plunked down on the linoleum in the in the church hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Had a pretty good sleep.
Yeah. And also pancake mix was available for breakfast. So that's what we had. So thank you, Dayville Presbyterian. And if you're going through that way, I recommend a stop because it's free and they're nice.
It's amazing.
They do take donations.
You don't find places like this very often. I mean, we've been around and this is definitely a find.
Yeah. We had really, really terrible terrain leaving Antelope. Yeah. The ride out of Antelope past is now a Young Life camp used to be Rajneeshpuram, where the Bhagwan Rajneesh tried to start his own civilization in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, look up that history if you're interested in it. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. We descended into the valley, and it was a beautiful descent. It's decently paved for the purpose, although the hill was really steep, but the views were spectacular. The county road completely falls apart after that. It goes into Jefferson County and becomes not really a road at all, and we pushed our bikes uphill for like 2 hours or something like that.
Yeah, I felt kind of bad because I'd found this road on the Oregon state map, and I thought, well, it says it's unpaved, but it made it to the state map, so...
It's on the
state
map.
Like, really, how bad could it be? Let's go for it. And Brock said, sure, let's do it. So my idea kind of got us into 3-inch deep sand at the top of this pass at probably 3,000 feet up.
Yeah, so the Painted Hills
no
are beautiful.
No end in sight.
Unless you're trying to ride through them.
Yeah, the red dirt is really pretty unless you're trying to haul your bike up it for
Actually,
a while.
Actually, red dirt is the best dirt to ride on. The green dirt is a lot less compliant.
So that day, and I think the day before when we were climbing up from the Deschutes out of Maupin, I was caught swearing at the ground multiple times and almost throwing my bike down at the hill.
Is it 25 miles unpaved,
right?
I was
so angry. I was so angry. But I don't think I'd really settled into the pace of bike touring yet.
Yeah.
So I was caught off guard by how angry and miserable I was feeling.
I have to work. Indeed we do.
I don't feel happy, so that was sort of my motto for the first 2 days was, I've had more fun than this, but I think I've worked that out of my system now, and I'm pretty okay with, like, just taking the pain and the obstacles as they come, and now I won't feel bad about maybe listening to a podcast or two if the mountains get long and steep like we're going to do later this afternoon up into the Strawberries.
We head to the hills.
Yeah.
Also, if you go into a small town and nothing is open, look for a person and ask them where you can camp. That's what we did in Antelope. And a very nice lady told us that we could stay in the town RV park, which has actually been repossessed by some bank. And its only inhabitant is what she described as a quiet drunk.
A quiet drunk.
He was very nice. So, anyways, yeah, I recommend that as well. That's week one.
Yeah, week one. Done and done.
Adieu, everybody.
Goodbye.
There you go.
It's kind of amazing to me that I've told that my story to a few people.
Right. You mentioned you were on KBOO.
I was on KBOO.
Did your notes there.
So. I've had 798 people read my blog story about it, nice. Which is a lot of hits for me. You know, it's how I spent my summer vacation.
And you said you did it in 6 days.
I did it in 6 days.
I
did it in 28 hours and 5 days. And I say 28 hours because that's how fast the first finisher,
right.
Ira Ryan, did it. I just ran into him the other day and I couldn't say anything except, 28 hours. And he just laughed.
I wonder if he gets either... If he's, like, kind of proud of that, of people knowing him for that, or if he's just kind of tired. Yeah, 28 hours.
I can't imagine he's tired of hearing about it. Yeah. He must be proud. He's got a lot to be proud of. I mean, it was six kind of challenging days. Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of easier days for me, but it was, you know, it was six pretty good bike ride days. To boil that down into 28 hours is... bewildering.
Yeah. To me. So what was your average mileage?
I wanted to do about 60 miles a day.
Okay.
Because
those are pretty
of
good days on normal road, just regular. I mean, it's a decent day.
That's a decent day.
It's not too far, not too
yeah.
short. You know, it's
on your road bike in Lycra with nothing but a spare tube and a candy bar. 60 miles is still a respectable distance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out in the wilderness, climbing, negotiating bizarre surfaces with, you know, 30, in my case, 30 pounds of crap with you. That's a little different of
yeah.
a day, but it's also touring mentality. So loaded tourists on their bikes, on their road bikes, which are awesome. I love loaded touring. You know, you could go do a loaded tour that's 60 miles and it's different than the first scenario on your road bike with Lycra and a candy bar, because you've got all day.
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
actually want to race and get to camp at 2 p.m.
No.
You're going to be cold
you're gonna
and bored.
Stop. You're going to look around. You're going to take some pictures or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
And the Outback was no different, you know.
Okay.
You've got all day. I had my sights set on certain campgrounds. I'd done a lot of studying of the maps. Donnie at Velodirt, the organizer, I'm so thankful to him. For finding this route and other routes that Velodirt has put on and then sharing them and doing it in such a way that you still have to do the legwork yourself. He's saying, everybody's going to go out and do this bike ride and it's from here to here. Look out for that one part, but otherwise, you know, here's a good map to buy. figure it out. We're not here to save you. So
right.
It's really nice knowing going in.
So it's a resource in a way, or he provided a resource for people who want to do the more self-guided touring.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more...
it's more like an X
yeah,
on a calendar than a research. And
yeah,
I would be remiss
yeah.
if I didn't mention, Donnie has a new website. It's called, oh my gosh, I believe it is called OregonBikepacking.com.
All right.
He just rolled that out. If I'm wrong about the website name, I apologize. And you can find it through Velodirt,
yeah.
I'm sure. But, you know, it's really cool. So for people who are listening who have not heard of bike packing, it's kind of a mashup between bike packing backpacking and loaded touring. So you take your ultra lightweight camp gear and you strap that on your mountain bike, cyclocross bike, whatever bike you can, hopefully with fatter tires, depending on the terrain you're going to traverse. I had Continental X-King 2.2. Okay. I was very happy to have that much width. And you're out in nature and you're camping and, you know, the state of Oregon, I was already in love with it. this trip from Klamath Falls to the mouth of the Deschutes River where it meets the Columbia, it was unbelievably beautiful. I mean, just every day had jaw-dropping vistas. Leaving Klamath Falls on the OC&E trail, just astonishing. I mean, I felt like I could just see the entire state of Oregon rolled out in front of me. It's this huge valley, surrounded by mountains and, you know, that blue wavy thing that you get with mountains in the distance.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, getting to the Prineville Resort was so beautiful. I actually was crying on my bike. It didn't hurt that I had run out of water and now I can see the reservoir.
Oh, yeah. It's sort of like that sense of relief that you get.
Yeah. I made it.
Yeah.
So,
all the endorphins, all the sort of reward chemicals in your brain, like all release at once. And yeah.
And knowing too, feeling. Like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to die of dehydration because there's the reservoir.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned a couple different kinds of bikes. So were there a lot of different kinds of bikes on the...
There were mostly mountain bikes, mm-hmm. mostly 29er, meaning 29-inch wheel mountain bikes.
Yeah.
But there were also cyclocross bikes. You know, Ira Ryan did it on a cyclocross bike, I believe. Bike packing in general... I imagine you can do it on just about any bike,
uh-huh.
and you can buy the Revelate bags and that strap right to your bike, or you can do it the way I did it with a rack and panniers and just kind of traditional. The difference is your destination and how much stuff you have to carry.
Okay.
And when I say destination, I mean where you're going to be riding.
Right. As opposed to, you know, staying on roads or marked... bike paths.
You know,
you guys are, this was mostly an off-road trail.
This was almost completely off-road.
Yeah.
And there were parts of the off-road that were really easy texture, just soft dirt, a couple pebbles thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other parts that were heinously tough.
Oh.
There's an area.
It's red dirt, yeah.
I'm showing Aaron a picture right now of the red dirt.
Yes.
Actually, I think people started calling it the red sauce. I called it the Martian sandscape. It's really beautiful. You're in the desert. There's sagebrush everywhere. There's nobody around. It's just gorgeous. I shouldn't say there's nobody around. There's other outback riders around if you're lucky. And then you get to this 20-mile loose gravel stretch is how Donnie had described it. It was not loose gravel. It was deep sand, and it varied. So you'd have a mile of deep sand where you're just pedaling and your wheels are just kind of spinning.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get to another section where it's not as deep and you're like, yeah, it's over. And then
it comes back again.
It's not over. So that was really tricky. You've got to change. You know, I'm a roadie. I've always ridden on the road. Tarmac is really predictable. The way it interacts with your tires, super predictable. Getting on these off-road jaunts opens up so much nature, so many views, just a lot of adventure and exploration, but you've got to be ready that it's not predictable as far as road surface.
You develop more of a relationship between you and your road or whatever it is you're riding on.
You do. You have a big relationship with it. You break up. You get back together again, you get in fights. And, you know, a part of it that makes it work for me is having that mentality of, okay, I'm not going to go 20 miles an hour. I'm not going to finish these next 20 miles in an hour. I'm pedaling hard and slipping out, and I'm going 6 miles an hour. And that's fine. It's hard, but I'm just going to accept that 20 miles, that the distance is a different timetable. So,
so you also at some point have to reconcile in your brain. I don't know if this was for you. It seems like it though. Like if you have a specific goal or destination for your mileage of the day and you realize somewhere in the middle of the day, you're not going to make it. You have to sort of kind of reconcile that with yourself.
You got to roll with it. Yeah. And, you know, different people do it differently. Some people will just keep riding till they get to their destination, even if that means dark.
Oh.
I think I only stayed, I went according to plan with one exception, and I went further because it was hot and it was afternoon. Mm. And, this was coming into Prineville. So I think the plan was to camp at the Crooked River, and then I had 15 or 20 more miles to Prineville, and it was paved. It's hot afternoon. I had heard there was a brew pub in Prineville, so that made it easy to...
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like any other bike thing. You've got to be resilient and just accept that things may not go precisely as planned. You know, talking about this Martian sandscape, the red sauce, everybody hated it, and myself included.
Yeah.
But, and also I'd like to make as a side note, I did 30 miles of the red sauce because there was a turnoff that we were supposed to take and I missed
it. And you missed it. Oh.
So I was on the red sauce a little bit longer, and, I'm actually grateful for it because I would get so freaked out in the past if I fishtailed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I popped out of that 30-mile torturous landscape, I was a different bike handler.
Fishtailing was just something you did at that point. Like, and so it was just like, yeah, I fishtailed now.
Yeah. Oh, I slipped out. Okay. Nothing bad happened. And
of course, and, it's different when you're going 20 miles an hour and you fishtail versus, you know, however...
True.
Fast you're going on the dirt.
You know, and I think of Ira and Jan Heim and all these other really tough riders who did it so quickly and on smaller, you know, narrower tires than I had. And I'm blown away. That is some incredible bike handling to be able to scoot through that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be interesting to hear how they ran through that.
So, you know, I'd mentioned that this was like, I called it Martian Sandscape School because I learned so much from it. And that section is kind of a microcosm of the entire Oregon Outback for me because, I mean, I won't lie to you, I was pretty scared starting off. There was so much buildup. There are so many warnings and, you know, so many really tough riders and...
Was there, as you are getting ready, because you all started basically at the same time, right?
Oh, yes.
We started like a master. So was there a time, like, as you're looking around, are you thinking, like, oh my gosh, I'm not this caliber of rider. I don't know if I can, like, was it ever like that for you?
A little bit. Okay. You know, I've been a cyclist for a long time and pretty confident in my cycling. But I was one of the oldest people out there. Definitely, I think for sure the oldest lady out there.
Really?
I definitely, absolutely had the kind of most slapped together gear of anybody. I mean, people had really nice bikes and really nice stuff.
So this is a testament that you don't have to have the grade A everything to do this.
You don't have to have grade A anything, and that includes experience. And the reason I'm excited to share my Oregon Outback story is because I want to help open the doors, like Donnie opened the door for me, to people who feel like this is out of reach, to people that feel like this is something just for super endurance, really tough riders. No, this is for anybody. If it sounds interesting, you can do it. You've got to prepare. You've got to have some fitness. You've got to have some gear, but it certainly doesn't need to be the top of the line gear, and it doesn't need to be, you know, the latest bike. I did it on a 26-inch wheeled aluminum GT that I believe is from the 90s or possibly the 80s.
It says Black Woods.
It's the Backwoods.
Yeah.
And, you know, this bike took excellent care of me. I was lucky. I didn't have any mechanicals. There were a lot of really experienced riders who didn't finish because they, you know, something went wrong.
Uh-huh.
And that can happen to anybody. So I really encourage people to go out and try it. And it's right in your backyard, this kind of bike packing idea. It's loaded touring, but you go off-road, at least for the end. And I should mention, I'm a co-leader for a group called Cycle Wild.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend Ed Groth and I, are putting on a trip mid-August. I believe it's August 16th and 17th. And we're still sussing out territory to ride in, but we're going to do it as a beginner bike packing.
Okay.
So if anybody's listening is interested to that, keep your eye on the Cycle Wild website. We'll be rolling out details soon.
16th and 17th is a Saturday, Sunday?
Yeah, so it'll just be a weekend. Probably less than 50 miles each way, but free camping, as Ed calls it, which means there's no shower, there's nowhere to plug your phone in.
So I think the technical term, the quote, legalese for this is dispersed camping?
Mm.
Yeah.
Dispersed camping. Yeah. I like the idea of free camping, too.
Yeah. I grew up calling it bandit camping.
Oh, yeah. We used to call it guerrilla camping.
So you're mentioning this sense of kind of being really freaked out when you first started.
Really freaked out when I first started. By the time I finished, you know, it was a vacation for me.
Right.
I have so many adventures and stories and new friends, and so it was such a learning ground for me, and it really reinforced my confidence because, you know, I had so much self-doubt, like, oh my God, I've definitely got the fitness, but the bike handling is not that great, you know, I've just been addicted to asphalt for so many years, so getting out there and just doing it. And, you know, I think a big part of it is being willing to fail. And so knowing as I'm, you know, getting passed by everybody on the chunky, rocky section of the first trail, the OC&E rail line trail, just being okay with that and just saying, well, okay, they go fast, I go slow. You know, when I was riding with a group, especially if there was a descent, I would go very slow. And I just didn't want to fall and get hurt and ruin all my packs and stuff. So, and I managed to never fall. So that's pretty cool.
Hey, yeah.
But I would do this thing of making chicken sounds, because I felt like a chicken, you know, I felt scared I was going to fall. And then I also was super aware that other riders were going a lot faster than me. And I didn't want to surprise anybody and have them, you know, get.
So like, as you were slowing down, you didn't want anyone like running, rear-ending you.
Right. You know, the roadie would turn back and say, slowing, and maybe make a hand signal. And so apparently the Outback version of that is making chicken sounds. And that was very effective. So I'm putting together a team for next year. And
to do the same ride?
To do the Outback again.
Okay.
So the Oregon Outback is a route that goes across the state, south to north, kind of right through the middle of the state. And it's, you can do it right now. Anybody can do it anytime. It's probably pretty darn hot out there right now. You know, if you get into the colder months, you might encounter snow. So you've got that to consider. But you can find the route on Ride with GPS, on the Velo Dirt website. You know, if you go on Facebook and put hashtag Oregon Outback, you'll get a lot of information. And that was another really cool thing about riding this ride is I felt like it was like this opening, almost like in the old pioneer days, like the opening of the West.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So Donnie and his friend Gabe had gone out last year in 2013, did this as their own adventure and then shared it and then created it as a event for this year with a calendar date and everything. And that's really fun. That's especially fun for me to go out there with 200 people who, you know, I saw lots of people a lot of the times, but I also had a couple days where I was completely alone. But anybody at any time can just go out and do that now. So that's really cool. There's tons of routes. I mean, they're all over the state. We live in a beautiful area. And you don't get to see as much of it on the road as you do off the road.
No, the highway system, the way it's designed, is for mobility, not necessarily for viewing.
Yeah.
You know?
It's almost like comparing riding a bike to driving in a car. So you're in the car, you don't really get to see stuff, you're going by it fast, you don't really get to experience stuff up close. You're on the bike on the road, and now you're really smelling and seeing and experiencing things. And then take it one step further, now you're out with fat tires in the woods, you're going really slow and really seeing stuff up close. You don't have any distractions of cars or anything. Really cool stuff.
Was there a time, let me think. Well, let's talk about seeing things. You mentioned a lot of the scenery. Was there like any animals out there? Like, I know for myself anyways, being
well, there was
far
the big
south
chicken
and
on my bike.
Oh yeah. But being that far south, like I know like, okay, this is kind of getting into California bear country a little bit. You know,
I was nervous about
bears.
It's
one of the things
yeah.
I've used to talk myself out of camping on my own is just knowing like there's enough wildlife out there. Maybe wouldn't eat me, but at least scare me.
If you're going to go camping in bear country, you have to bring one friend with you and they need to be slower than you. And then you're fine. And hopefully you're not that good of friends.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was scared about bears, but in the end I left my bear spray home. I just didn't have room for it. Mm-hmm. I never saw a bear. I never heard of anybody who saw a bear. I mean, there was lots of fowl. There's lots of birds. I think I see more animals when I'm on a day ride in the country around Portland. You know, seeing llamas and mini buffaloes and all the millions of goats and chickens and all that.
Sure. And
besides
then,
birds,
this is
I
a harsher landscape to, you know, for wildlife to be living in.
It is a harsher landscape, and that kind of brings up another topic, another surprise. You know, we had to carry our own water. There were big sections with not even a creek. And then there were many sections where that's all there was a creek. And so you had to sterilize your own water and be prepared. And you're, you know, physically pushing it. You've got to stay hydrated or you can get in big trouble. So what I've encountered when I'm out on a day ride on my road bike is that the car drivers, the pickup truck drivers around that area don't seem super welcoming or happy to have me there. Mm. They'll do that rolling coal thing or even toss a bottle at you or maybe flip you off, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah.
But
I've had a few encounters where I don't know the driver's intention, but it does seem like they're riding that line a little closer than they would if nobody was.
Maybe. Whatever it is, it's not a language of welcome.
No, certainly not.
And what I experienced in the middle of our great state was the complete opposite.
I've heard that.
Every
about
human.
The small towns around
the small towns, but also just the individuals you'd encounter. Every human I saw was friendly, not too friendly. You know, I've gotten that too, where they're like, "Oh, where are you? Where'd you start? Where are you riding to?" But start interviewing you.
Yeah.
But I would have, you know, an ATV would go by. They'd stop, turn their engine off so I can hear them, and ask me if I had enough water.
Oh, nice.
At one point, we rolled into some burg, and burg is even too big of a word for it. It was like a house and a grange hall and a farm, and that was like this little Four Corners town.
Uh-huh.
And there's a farmer standing out in his yard waving his arms at us. He waves us over. He wants to make sure that we fill up our water bottles before the 5-mile hill. Just amazing stuff like that.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's, who's it? Russ and Laura, the past Pathless Pedal.
Yes.
A lot of their reports about Eastern Oregon and then a lot of the country rides that they've written about. That's been almost universal is how welcoming everybody in the small towns are and just people along the way. And it's funny because here in the city, Portland itself being so bike friendly, there is this mentality. I don't know if it totally matches up with the reality of it, but there is a sort of car versus bike mentality, at least undercurrent.
There can be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of us. It's an urban landscape. Everybody's being slowed down or inconvenienced. I get it.
Mm.
It's fine.
It's less about the mode of transportation as it is about the density.
I think that's accurate. I think that's fair. And then a little bit of the opposite of that, when you get into more far-flung, you know, if you're riding out past Estacada, for example, they don't see many bikes out there. And so you're inconveniencing them. They don't understand what you're doing out there. And that's fine. I don't really have a lot of bitterness about that. But it just was really, I don't know, heartwarming to encounter so many super friendly people. And, you know, the way people, they had seen others of us. I mean, there's 200 of us out there.
Right.
We were tripling the population of towns as we rode through them. And it, just people were so welcoming. It just really lit me up. And, you know, part of it too, there was a day I got lost. Day two, we'll call it.
Okay.
So
that wasn't the time that you missed this turnoff.
No, that was the second time I got lost. I didn't bring a GPS with me. I really studied the maps and, anyway, whatever. It's fine. People get lost. But that first day or the first time I got lost on day two, that was really tough. I was all alone. I had downloaded this app onto my phone that was supposed to help and it wasn't helping. And I felt like an idiot and I thought for sure the whole trip was ruined. And, at that point I saw a car finally. Now I'm on pavement. I have no idea what road this is. There's no signs anywhere. I can tell I'm kind of vaguely going north-ish. Mm-hmm. And I see a car and I have just never been so happy to see somebody. And I wave them down, which is against all of my policies to ever wave down a car. And the man stops and I ask him the road and he tells me and it's the road I want. And I'm just so elated. And so there's this mood of you're out on your own. And you see somebody and you wave, you know. So I was waving everybody I saw, I would wave at them. And I'd like to bring a little bit of that back to urban riding with me. I mean, you can't do that on your commute.
Right.
But out on a day ride in the country around Portland, to be as a cyclist, to initiate the friendliness by waving at the car. So that's what I'm going to start doing. Starting tomorrow.
Tomorrow's always the best day to start those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. What other takeaways do you have from this? Oh, no. Wait, before we start with that.
Yes.
Because there's a really interesting story you told me a while back. It was a Pedalpalooza ride we shared. And you had just gotten back from the Outback. This is an interesting story that I don't know if you've told with anybody else, and so if you're tired of telling that, that's fine. But somebody whose bike was lost in transit?
Oh, yeah. This is a great story, and I haven't told it. So there were some people that came from Minneapolis to do our little Oregon Outback. It's just awesome. So on the Thursday before the ride, a massive amount of us converge on the Amtrak station downtown Portland. And that includes these two young ladies from Minneapolis. And, you know, a lot of people don't know each other. We're all milling around together. It's obvious that we're all these bike packers because of the gear we're carrying. And it's kind of a festive atmosphere. Everybody's excited. There's a couple hours till the train comes still. And then there's this one woman and she's on the phone and she's crying and, you know, there's kind of a hush and people are eavesdropping naturally. And it turns out her bike has been lost, temporarily. She got it back in the end, but so they had flown from Minneapolis to Portland, but they put their bikes on trains.
Right, the Amtrak freight.
Yeah, it was cheaper. And then since they were going to be joining the Portland crew on the train to Klamath Falls, it kind of made sense for them.
Yeah.
Then they would just get their boxed bike from one train, put it on the other. And I think there were three of them in their party, and two of them got their bikes. but the one lady had put her bike on a different train, and that train was stuck behind a cargo train that had derailed.
Oh, no. So, yeah, there was, like, no way she was going to get it. It's not late. It's just stuck.
It's stuck. It's in Montana. Our train's leaving in 2 hours. Everybody there really empathized. I mean, the Oregon Outback, it's a big deal. It has a hashtag.
Yeah. People building up for this. For
the press, the media, this, you know, there's so much buzz about it. And I bought a lot of stuff. I took the vacation time. It's a big deal to me. And I just rode my bike to the train station. I can't imagine what a big deal it is to these people who've flown from Minneapolis. And, you know, you can just see it in her face, like her ride just got ruined. Her vacation just got ruined.
Yeah.
So she's crying, and then she's embarrassed that she's crying, and she's backing away. And meanwhile, she doesn't know this, but in the little crowd of us, there's a handful of bike industry people.
You being one of them.
Me being one of them. I work at Western Bike Works, and we are all scrambling. I'm calling my boss. Everybody's calling their shop and saying, what can we do? What can we do? So Selwood Cyclery, bless their hearts, they won.
They won the nice award,
the Good Samaritan Award. Not only did they have exactly the right bike for her with exactly the pedals she needed, but they drove it down to the station for her and delivered it to her and charged her nothing.
Wow.
So I'm really proud to work in an industry where that happens, you know, and thank you, Selwood Cyclery. I don't even know who did it, but awesome. I wish it had been my shop, and then I would be advertising it. You guys should advertise it. It's good marketing.
So she got her bike. She was able to do
it. And I ran into her out on the trail. There's a picture of her here somewhere. And I asked her, I mean, you know, I got fitted to my bike. I had like my system. I had everything set up in a certain way. And so, you know, just jumping on this other strange bike, I can imagine would be a little
At least concerning. For the first few miles, I'm sure. For me, my notion would be to get off, like adjust the seat or adjust the bars, ride it some more, get off, like do some more adjustments. And
you know, the way your load is, that's another dimension of potential problems. But anyway, I ran into her probably 30 miles into day one. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, how's that loaner bike treating you? And she said, oh, it's great. It's
nice. Fine.
Yeah. So she wasn't having any problems. And I don't recall her name, but I've learned since then that she is very experienced at this kind of bike packing, off-road endurance stuff.
Okay.
So apparently not a huge deal for her to just change bikes like that.
I see.
Good for her.
So one thing I'm getting from this is the more you do these bike packings, the more versatile you might be as a cyclist.
I think that's fair. My bike handling has only improved since I started doing velo dirt rides in general, mm-hmm. and the Outback in specific. It's, you know, it's a different thing, and it's a different mind game too. So on the kind of riding, my riding background is road distance.
Yeah. Have you've done cyclocross though too? No.
Oh, I raced cyclocross once. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking like you were part of the circuit as well, because I know you do like randonneuring and like other racing stuff.
I do randonneuring. I occasionally race. Okay. You know, I try and go to every bike ride I hear about. I also have a good length commute, so I ride a lot.
Yeah.
But mostly pavement and. On the randonneur rides, on the distance rides, there's a formula you use. You know, you're like, okay, well, I'm going 18 miles an hour. The next stop is in 18 miles. We'll be there in an hour. Usually the math isn't that easy, but
right.
It gives me something to think about while I'm riding. And then you translate stuff into time, and that really helps. So instead of saying like, oh my gosh, how much longer? You're like, how much further till we get there? Then you can just say, oh, we'll be there in an hour. Just keep pedaling, and in an hour, I'll be rolling up to the One Horse Saloon in Gaston and drinking a beer, or whatever the case might be. And so for bike packing and for off-road stuff, you just have a different thing in the formula, a different hardness factor. So it's a cool thing. So what else do we have here?
Yeah, I see you looking at your notes here.
I have a list of notes.
Well, before I interrupted myself, I was going to ask, like, what other takeaways did you have from this? Like, even off the bike, is there something that you just took away just for everyday life, like not even necessarily related to riding?
It's hard to articulate exactly, but, you know, any of these really hard bike things, they force me to meet myself. They force me, there's no hiding. There's no day-to-day life, walking along, whistling, everything's fine. Mm-hmm. You're out there in the middle of nowhere. You could get screwed and potentially even die. And so this is what I'm doing for my vacation. The couple of days that I was lost and I'm totally alone, there's a lot of thinking that goes on. There's a lot of pedaling that goes on, but there's also a lot of thinking that goes on. And so it's hard to quantify it exactly, mm-hmm. but I came out the other end of the Outback more myself than when I had started.
Yeah.
And that's something I experience over and over again on hard bike rides. And I think it's one of the reasons I love them.
You said you meet yourself. In a way, you learn to really reconcile with your fears and with your anxieties. And
yeah.
And you build maybe some self-soothing techniques or...
Definitely some self-soothing techniques. When I was really lost on day two and, you know, the sun's getting higher, it's noon. I've only got 20 miles on my odometer since I left camp because I'm not sure where I'm going and I'm going up the hill and, oh, I don't think this is it. And going back down the hill. Oh no. I'm losing time. I'm starting to make those dumb mistakes and I'm recognizing it. Mm. And so, you know, you have to let the logic brain take over. And so I stop and then I think about it for a minute and I hear my dad's voice. And so my dad, it's very much the voice of logic. He's very much a soothing voice by just inserting rational thinking into my head.
He's able to sort of take the emotional, sort of irrational brain out of the equation.
Yeah.
For you.
So, yeah. You know, it's not like I'm hearing voices, but my dad's logic and it's saying, okay, stop, but stop somewhere where you'll be seen. So I go back down to the road I had passed a ways back and mm-hmm. I stop down there and then look at the maps. Just don't move. I've already lost a bunch of time. Doesn't matter. Look at the maps. You know, I had been like crying. I had been really upset because I'm thinking like, this is a kind of a famous ride. Everybody's following it. Everybody's going to know that I failed.
You're the one who, yeah.
That I had to like call a school bus to come get me or whatever, yeah. You know? So I'm picturing all of these horrible scenarios and then emotionally reacting to them. And so then, you know, dad's voice comes in. It's like, no, it's a bike ride. Everything's fine. We're going to keep pedaling.
You haven't had to call anybody yet.
There's, you know, maybe I won't make the cowboy dinner tree. This is this really cool restaurant in the middle of nowhere. You have to make a reservation in advance. You don't get to order. There's no menu. You choose when you make the reservation if you want an entire roasted chicken or a 30-ounce steak.
That's right.
I got the 30-ounce steak. My reservation was for 5:30 on Saturday, which seemed like a really reasonable time when I made it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll miss my reservation. If that's the worst thing that can happen, I'm going to miss my reservation and I won't see anybody again on the Oregon Outback, but I'm going to do it. And it's my dad's voice saying all this. And so looking at the map and it's like, okay, well, I'm positive that's the wrong way. You know, you just do elimination.
Mm-hmm.
I'm positive that's the wrong way. Definitely don't want to go east. I generally want to go north. I'm just going to get on this paved road and just keep following it as long as it goes north. and just figure that out. And so this is the same day that I then saw that motorist.
Right.
Who confirmed it was the road
that
I wanted.
That you needed to be on anyway.
And yeah. then it was only a few miles after him that that paved road turned back into gravel and I could see the tire tracks.
Oh,
so
right, right.
When yeah. you're following
that's,
200.
That's one of the, I was going to say, that's one of the advantages of being on.
Well, yes road. And no. Yeah. I kind of, so it was reassuring because mm-hmm. there's the millions of bike tire tracks. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay. but it also, it's partly how I got lost.
Because?
I was on the Oceania Trail, and then you're supposed to turn off at this whatever paved fire road. But the Oceania Trail continues up to the Sycan Marsh. I don't know if I'm saying it right. So I saw tire tracks, and I kept going.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, so, yeah, this is it. So I'm not the only one. I haven't heard anybody else confess, but other people
somebody else had to.
Continued. And it's uphill, hot, and it's dicey. It's just, okay, picture a dice, mm-hmm. a die, maybe four times that and pointy. And so it's that kind of terrain. And then that fizzles out, and now it's sagebrush, and I'm still going through these gates. The gates were a lot of fun. I have a picture of one here somewhere. And the, where'd my gate picture go? Anyway, now the gravel is gone, and it's just dirt and sagebrush. And so I'm riding my bike, and I'm dodging sagebrush, and then the gravel picks up again. And I don't see tire tracks, but it's a different kind of gravel. So I'm like, well, that's okay. This just doesn't leave tire tracks. And I stop and I look back and there's my track, clear as day.
Oh,
the only one. So, you know, somebody else went up. They didn't make it as far as I did.
Right.
And who knows, maybe there's some poor schmuck who was actually after me that followed my tire tracks up.
And just went, oh, this still is...
But,
yeah.
So, and that, you know, that was, once I was back on track, that was one of the most beautiful days, just so gorgeous. The terrain, I felt like there was one of those movie, sets just being rolled past me.
Oh, nice.
The terrain was changing so fast. And so at one point I run into an ATV guy who offers me water. And I ask him, I'm like, am I getting close to the cowboy dinner tree? And he says, yeah, it's right around the corner. So for the second time that day, I wanted to kiss a stranger. So I rolled into the driveway of the cowboy dinner tree at 5:15.
Oh, so you still made your reservation?
15 minutes before my reservation. I can't even tell you how against the odds that was. I just couldn't believe it after the day I had had. And then I start seeing other Outback riders and everything seems normal again. And I'm like, what the heck? What a weird day.
Yeah.
And at that point, so I'd like to talk about my team a little bit. Mm. There were a team of three of us and we called ourselves Team Relegate because there was a lot of talk about the rules if you're racing. The Outback in general, but also just endure, you know, there's that Continental Divide race and... So they're talking about the Outback is not a race, but if you are racing it, you have to, you know, you can't accept outside support. And this kind of list of rules. Velodirt and Donnie, they don't really believe in rules, so it was just kind of casual.
Yeah.
But they kept using the word relegate in this one article I read. So if you decide to accept outside support, just relegate yourself to tourist. Relegate yourself. So we decided to be Team Relegate.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe that was a bad team name because I'm the only one that finished. My one teammate, 20-year-old kid, kind of new to cycling, mm-hmm. but really hardcore. He made it halfway through day one and his knee was just swelling and swelling and swelling.
Oh no.
And he quit early on because his dad had given him a car ride down and he wanted to get a hold of his dad before he drove, you know, all the way back up.
Sure.
So that's a shame. He said he'll try it again next year. And then my other teammate, who's like a 50-something-year-old roadie guy who bought a 29er and bought the Relevate bags and all this cool stuff, he didn't make the start. He had a work emergency that he had to turn back.
Oh, no.
So when I rolled into the cowboy dinner tree, there he was. I couldn't believe it. He had matched his reservation to mine. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, you drove all the way down here just to have dinner with me? And then he stepped aside and there behind him was his bike.
Oh.
He's back on.
So he didn't make the start, but he still was.
So he didn't make the start, but then he joined me for dinner. We did our best to eat those steaks. Oh my gosh, it was the best steak I've ever had. And then we rolled the 5 miles to camp and then he's back on. So he started, his day one was my day three. And then I rode with him for a couple days. We were in Prineville together eating dinner and he couldn't, close his hand around his fork.
Oh.
And I thought he was kind of clowning around like, oh, I'm so tired. I can't close my hand.
Yeah.
But the next day he was done.
Hmm.
His hand, was numb all night. And so he didn't want to have permanent nerve damage. No. So
it's just from the way he was riding, was pinching a nerve or something?
Probably. You know, there's a big difference. I guess that's advice I would give to somebody too, who's going to try, a bike packing adventure. Spend some time on the bike, before you go on your adventure. I commuted on my mountain bike to kind of get used to it.
Right.
And that hand position is so different than a road bike. And then add into the equation that you're carrying weight. You can tend to really hold your hands tight. And so, you know.
And the difference between mountain bike bars and drop bars. It's drop bars, you know, you can move your hands around a little bit more. There's different positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you put the add-ons on your mountain bike bars, you know, you really just have the one position and, you know, you can kind of move your hands around a little bit, but as far as like keeping a grip onto those bars, it's just the, like that.
Yeah. And you know, your wrists and arms are turned at a different angle.
Yeah.
So if you're really used to being a roadie and riding in the hoods and now you're on a mountain bike and your hands are kind of splayed out flat, it's a very different thing.
It's a wider position.
It's wider.
Yeah.
So some of the bikes that I really lusted after the most were mountain bikes that have been equipped with drop bars.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen those.
So that's becoming a thing. And, you know, the Oregon Outback, with all of its buzz, there's some frame builders who are making Oregon Outback bikes. And a lot of them made the bike, did the Outback this year, and now they're perfecting it. I can think of three off the top of my head. Joshua Bryant, Ira Ryan of Breadwinner Cycles, and Joseph Ahern.
Finished in
28 Hour guy. And then Joseph Ahern. So,
oh, really? He's building he built
one for a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
And they missed the registration cutoff. Donnie kind of made a quantity cutoff.
Right.
So they went the week ahead.
Oh, okay.
I was really glad because, you know, I made my friend promise, text me all the advice you can. So every couple days when he was out there, I'd get a text saying, Loctite all bolts.
Ah.
Just little nuggets like that. So my friend rode one of Joseph's new machines. And it looks a lot like a road bike, rando bike setup. So it takes really fat tires.
Mm-hmm.
It's got cantilever brakes, so more braking power.
All steel.
Steel.
Yeah.
My friend had a Brooks saddle on it, drop bars, and then lots of kind of mini racks. So, you know, carrying your gear is a fun, calculation, fun thing that equation that people come up with of.
Yeah. I've noticed people have, as opposed to, that's the picture I was looking at specifically, as opposed to having racks, that most like cycle tourists would have, they strap it to the frame. They
and
you know, the little sleeping bag that's strapped again to the handlebars and then little bags strapped to the fork.
So my interpretation of real bike packing, true bike packing setup, mm-hmm. as far as the gear, you have a frame pack, you've got a handlebar, pack of some sort. Maybe it's your sleeping bag in a compressed bag and just strapped to the bars. A lot of people would use their fork to hold some other stuff. And then a lot of people would have something that would maybe a mini support, not quite a rack, but some metal that would come out from behind their seat.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a strapping system, they could get like a big pack on there. So if you think of backpacking and how you carry stuff on your body, bike packing, they're carrying stuff on their bike that way.
Right.
Now, the way I did it and the way a lot of other people did it is, you know.
Yeah, you have like a couple.
I had panniers. I had a rack of panniers. I did have a frame pack that I made. It's very cute. It's not very burly, so I just had my tent poles and my raincoat and some little miscellaneous stuff in there. And then I had, very proud of this, the mega basket hydration system. So I ride with a little kid's plastic basket on every bike.
I like how you have that on there, yeah.
It's just my way. And I had started, you know, as I was sussing out my setup for the Outback with a little basket. And it wasn't big enough for the amount of water I wanted to carry because the frame pack displaces the water bottle cages.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, of course.
And you're going to want to hydrate on the go.
Right.
I don't want to stop and get off my bike and dig in my pack every time I'm thirsty.
And did you have like a Camelback then?
Or? I did not.
No.
I didn't want to
have
ride with anything on my body.
In the heat, and the, yeah.
Lots of people did.
Really?
Lots of people can do that. I can't handle stuff on my back. So anyway, I got a double size plastic basket. So if you picture your regular kid's plastic basket, it was twice that size. And then because of the curve of my mountain bike handlebars, I had to mount it backwards. When I first put it on, I was like, oh my gosh.
You were explaining that to me some time ago.
It looks so ridiculous. But whatever. Then maybe that's my style. It's ridiculous.
And it worked.
It totally worked. I had, you know, it's mounted with zip ties. I've got a bungee that holds everything in. I carried all my tools up there and then two water bottles. And so I had a whole system where I'd go through one water bottle, juggle it over to the other. And then when they were both empty, I'd stop, go in my pack, get my platypus and refill. So
you had a collapsible, is that right? Collapsible water tank?
Yeah. It's just like a little plastic bladder thing. Okay. And then when it's full, it can stand up. And so I actually carried a few of those. We were told that we should be able to carry 2 gallons of water.
Okay.
At any given time. So, you know, there's a lot of calculations because I've got, they want us to carry 2 gallons. I've got a 2-liter platypus, a 1-liter platypus, a 32-ounce water bottle, and 2 24-ounce water bottles. So I did a lot of math to try and figure out if that was 2 gallons. I never did figure it out, but it worked out fine.
It was close enough. You're here to tell us about it. So, I've been watching the clock behind you. I don't know how accurate it is, but we're button up. It's just after 9 here, and I know you need to get out and head to work. So, is there any like sort of last things to wrap up with?
I would just encourage people to open your mind to trying something like this, even if it seems really hard. And maybe think about doing the Oregon Outback next year on the date that is published. That way you'll have a lot of people out there with you. And the way you can start preparing now is, and this is part of the way I prepared, build unimproved roadways into your commute. So we all know Portland
has That's right.
miles of dicey blocks that are not paved. And it might seem kind of silly just riding 2 of those blocks on your way to work. But if you commute every day, it just starts adding up.
Yeah.
So that's one way. You know, another way is just ride and get that fitness up. And then the last way is go do loaded touring. If you're, you know, if you haven't done that, that's the perfect place to start. And there's lots of groups that you can go with. You can go on your own. There's lots of resources online. I have a friend, Ellie Tallheimer, who's written a couple books.
We've had her on the show a couple times.
Cycling Sojourner is a great resource. Cycle Wild is a really great group. So get out there.
We gotta have you on again now for Cycle Wild.
Oh boy. So get out there, get bike camping, loaded touring, start getting your idea of what your perfect gear setup is, and in no time at all, you'll be doing the Oregon Outback and getting interviewed on the Sprocket Pet podcast.
That's right. Oh, Maria, thank you so much for taking the time. I know, like, scheduling has been really tough.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
What ho?
Idaho. Are we taping right now?
We are taping. Oh. It's Brock.
It's Adele.
And we are 11 days into our trip.
We're looking across the Snake River at Idaho. Woo!
We're at the confluence of, what did I say, Pine Creek?
Pine Creek.
And the Snake River. Within view of the Oxbow Dam.
Which no one has probably heard of before, but...
But we're telling you about it. It's the Oxbow Dam.
Yeah, so it's been quite the week since our last update.
We checked in at John Day.
Yes.
And after John Day, we went down to the Malheur National Wildlife, or no, no National
first,
Forest.
First we went up into the Strawberry Mountains.
Yes, in the Malheur National Forest.
Mm-hmm. Very much up. Definitely wouldn't mistake that for down.
Yeah.
But we went south.
We did. Towards Burns, but not to Burns, because Burns is in the desert and we stayed in the forest.
That we did.
Ridiculous climbing. We had stopped to get some water, and what were described by people we met later as those hippies, they stopped and asked us if we needed water. We said, no, we don't need water. We don't need anything, but do you have anything, like, tasty?
Do you have anything else? Because we have so many people offer us water, and...
And we were carrying, like, 2 gallons combined.
And after being offered bacon a few years ago by that Canadian in Wyoming, I just totally have set the bar very high. So you said, well, do you have anything else? And they were like, there's this really long, awkward pause.
And then they
like ran around to the back of their van and flung open the door and pulled out this huge bin marked food and just started pulling things out of it. And they gave us granola and sausage and chocolate covered almonds.
Yes.
And a beer, a microbrew from Bend.
They did.
Where they were from.
Were we greedy? You be the judge. I did not make them give us anything.
I think I was blushing when they kept giving us food. I was embarrassed.
Yes.
Oh, I thought maybe we'd get like a couple raisins or something.
And to top it off, they told us about this campsite they had just left at Big Creek Campground, which they had vacated and did not plan to return to, but had paid for. So we stayed there in a beautiful place. So thank you, hippies, whoever you were from Bend. Wonderful people. This is karma. And I suppose that means we need to pay it forward, so hopefully we will.
Mm.
I intend to.
Yeah, so after the Strawberry Mountain kind of detour from the main eastward route, we turned back east and went...
We dropped down into Prairie City.
Up. Yeah.
Then we went out of Prairie City up another hill.
There's so much up and down, I'm confusing people.
We did 4 summits in one day, I think.
Yeah, that was a hard
3
day.
3 of which were signed as, 1 which was on the map as a summit but was not signed, but that counts.
And this was on Highway 26 as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Which, hey, turns into kind of a small little 2-lane highway that goes, kind of winds its way through the hills.
Highway 26 is not to be trifled with.
Yeah.
So, we landed by... Not Miller Lake, what's it called?
Phillips Lake, up in the Elkhorn Mountains.
Stayed a night there.
Never heard of the Elkhorn Mountains until then.
Never heard of Phillips Lake until then, but there we were. Saw some odd, large white birds. I don't know what they are. We should have asked the people with the binoculars, but we did not know. Adele, you almost fell into a swamp.
I did, yeah, to get
water.
To the river to get water, because the campground was dry. There was this... river off in the distance, maybe a quarter of a mile away, with this green field leading up to the river, and I was like, I'm gonna run across that field and show everyone that I can still run after biking 75 miles, or show myself. So I'm like running down to this field and I start running across it, and it was like a minefield of cow holes across of cow hoof prints that had been indented into this deadly deep mud,
right.
I can only assume, in the wet season.
We were dancing
season.
Across the crust, but a cow with a large body and a small hoof cannot
support
itself.
Yeah, so it was
itself.
Like, I don't know, the surface of the moon, or pockmarked by craters the
so
size of
water.
Cow hooves. So then I walked gingerly over to the river and filled up. I actually jumped in the river because I was absolutely covered in layers and layers of sweat.
We got to Baker City.
Yeah.
Baker City, it was a Monday, so Barley Brown's was closed, so we did not go to a brewery. It was sad. We could have stuck around, but we had so much more riding to do.
Or it might have opened at 2?
The bottle house, or whatever what do they call it, the bottling room. There was a tasting room that opened at 2.
So it just wasn't worth
it. The brewery opened at 4, and we had like 40 miles to go.
Which is awesome, because then we were really thirsty for beer by the time we got to Enterprise.
Right.
I'm fast-forwarding a few days.
But before that, we went to Pondosa, Oregon, tiny town. It's out, like, once you go over the desert, you think you're never going to see trees again. Then you see trees, and then there's Pondosa. It used to be a mill town.
In the foothills of the Wallowa Mountains.
Yes, on the western side. And Bob and his wife have lived there for 30 years. They moved there in 1983, and he sold us some sodas. The Pondosa store is his house, and the TV was on, and we had to walk through his living room to get to the store, which was in the kitchen, I assume, of the old house. It might have been a hotel at one point.
Yeah, it was. Anyways. Back when there was a sawmill.
Bob's a nice guy. We bought some postcards from the 70s. No joke, some of the postcards had the ridged edges, kind of the wavy edges that you don't see on postcards anymore. So, of course, I bought some.
And, of course, Brock only, I had no idea they were that old. Brock is a lover and curator of vintage 70 items.
Vintage is nice.
That was pretty cool. I was glad you recognized that.
We climbed and climbed. We got to Catherine Creek after another summit.
And before that, we had to turn down a guy from Eugene who stopped to say hi to us on the road.
Oh, right.
And
well, we talked to him.
Yeah, we had to turn down his delicious homegrown weed.
Right, he offered us some pot, and of course that's not our thing, so but it was nice to meet the guy.
It was fun
Eugene.
To chat with him. Yeah,
and he met us in the only shade for like 20 miles in each direction or something.
Yeah, it was cool to talk to someone out there in the desert,
and we just sat in the middle of the road.
I think we were all feeling a little crazy. Like, he seemed a little crazy because he'd been backpacking with his dog for 4 days.
True.
So he was kind of like a little twitchy and would have awkward pauses. I'm assuming that's because he'd been backpacking for 4 days by himself, because I definitely would get like that if I had been alone that long.
Next morning, looped through Union. Oh, right, we free camped in the forest. There's a lot of mosquitoes. I recommend if you free camp in the forest, make sure you find a place that's not super close to water. Mm-hmm. Also find a place where there's not an LDS camp, and all love to our LDS brethren, but they owned the land that the river was on, and there was a fence, and you weren't supposed to go across it. So, legally.
And it was supposed to be National Forest on the map.
Right, and it was where we were, but then the fence was by the river.
Not happy.
So it goes. Fill in the details for yourself, because we did get water. But if anyone broke the law, it was not us. It was someone like us, but legally distinct from us. Next morning, we dropped into Union, got some coffee, rolled around. We've been rolling around the Wallowa Mountains. We made it to... Oh, hey, birds. We made it to Lostine. Lostine is a beautiful place.
Yeah, and before that, I mean, I don't know how much detail we want to go in, but we camped by the wild and scenic Minam River deep in this canyon State Park. And it was a tiny campground, but it was like, it was fun. People were there to have a good time. And we were sandwiched between a group of maybe 10 people who were all like going to raft the river for 4 days. And then on the other side were these two brothers from... Pendleton.
Right, and Mike and Bryce gave us everything they had. They shared beers.
Which is a lot, because they had RVs.
Right. Mike stopped by the next morning and offered us a blackberry brandy to pour over our oatmeal, which we did. Syrup for our pancakes, he said.
Yeah, they were really just fun to hang out with.
Good
around
folks.
The campfire. Yeah.
The Lostines, the Lostine River is beautiful. There's a corridor. And it's incredibly steep. We climbed, I would say, 3 hours the first day, which took us about 20 minutes the next day to descend. We found I think at 4,900 feet, there's a guard station where there was water. There was a pump and a spring. And then we camped there overnight. That was when the rain started.
Yeah, and the rain didn't stop till...
until just 20 minutes ago.
36 hours later, or 2 days later, until just about now.
Yeah.
So we've been pretty wet and really just, we smelled really bad.
It was off and
on. It was
on.
Getting pretty gross. We hadn't showered in a week. And when you compound that with sweating a lot and then being wet for 2 days, it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
So by the time we rolled into this campground in Hell's Canyon, we were totally ready for these showers.
Indeed. Lots of up and down, lots of sweat, not a lot of things drying out and smelling good. So.
Yeah.
We are here.
Don't let that happen.
We are recharging on a Friday night. And Friday night's all right.
Yeah, tipping back some thin fire in Hell's Canyon.
That's right. Hell's Canyon. Hell may not be fiery. Hell may just be wet. So there's the Snake River. We cross that tomorrow, I think.
All right. Well, that will be our show. It was very enjoyable interviewing Maria this morning, and I hope you guys enjoyed the two little updates there from Brock and Adele. I am pushing it as far as closing time here at the IPRC, so we're going to call it a night. Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics or guests. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call and leave us a message or text us at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Thanks to Herb Bird for our headline sounder. And many thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, Katharina Mellengard, Roger Grigsby, Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson, Ethan Georgie, Justin Martin, and new donor, Tara Firma. Thank you all so much. Thank you for listening. Go to bed.
Bigger vacations like this take a little more editing. I really like this series because I was unbelievably happy here.
And this is where?
That's at the Cowboy Dinner Tree.
Okay. Okay.
So I have been lost all fucking day. All day. Lost and alone. Didn't think I'd make my thing and I didn't make it.
Speaking of good. Okay. So I'll just leave that there. So, Maria Schur, Oregon Outback.
A Sprocket Studios production.